Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, in light of the dazzling condition of the U.S. economy, we're going to take a look at the role of money in film and television throughout the years. Everything from the depiction of wealth in sitcoms to visions of the economy in futuristic utopias and dystopias. Returning as my guest is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who is a film blogger for Nerve.com, and whose website can be found at ludicid.com. It's ludickid.com. Welcome back to the show, Leonard.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back. Wish it was better times. I do a lot of writing for the Onion's AV Club, which is their entertainment and pop culture site, and every Monday they post at the site, which is avclub.com, what they call an inventory. It's basically just a pop culture list, and in light of the state of the economy, we decided that this week we would do a list of essential movies about living in poverty and living in desperate situations. So it's a topic that's been on my mind a lot lately as we put together that list of, you know, a number of great movies about people in dire financial circumstances, ranging all the way back to movies that were actually being made during the Depression. So,
well, Leonard, one of the many taglines of America is that it's the land of opportunity, where anyone can succeed and, above all, get rich. How has this impacted the depiction of wealth here in the States in contrast to other parts of the globe?
You know, of course, that was one of Ronald Reagan's taglines. Was, you know, he had a very famous line that he says, for me, America will always be a place where you can get rich. You know, that will always be America to me. And, you know, that's certainly been the depiction of America in both American films and in foreign films about America. Is it's always been this sort of land of infinite opportunity and infinite possibility where immigrants can come and make a, you know, make themselves wealthy. And, you know, of course, American films themselves tend to be, you know, at least mainstream successful films tend to reinforce that attitude that we live in a country of fairly infinite possibility. American films don't really emphasize the notion of class divisions because we officially have no class system here in America, at least according to the common wisdom. And in European movies, especially, I think, because they are a lot more immersed in class politics, modern Europe came about in a period of Marxist and socialist upheavals that really didn't hit here the way that they did in Europe. European movies are much more willing to talk about class issues, to portray people who live in poverty as their protagonists, and show them not really striving to become rich, but you're merely sort of striving to deal with their poverty and, you know, make a living for themselves, despite having no particular ambitions to become wealthy. And of course, that's given birth to entire genres of film, which don't really have an analog here in America. You know, for instance, the Italian neorealist movement of the 1940s and 50s was basically meant specifically to show the conditions of the working poor in Italy after World War II, you know, when the economy of Italy had pretty much been destroyed by the war and by Mussolini's economic policies. And so, and you don't really have an equivalent to that in America. You never had an entire movement where people were specifically setting out to depict the lives of poor people in America. And with very few exceptions, even the kinds of movies that were being made during the Depression in America were pretty hopeful. They were, you know, they were meant as light entertainment. And so you had a lot of movies like, you know, that were light comedies and showing people sort of doing the best that they could, maybe hitting it big, you know, and nonetheless sort of lightly dealing with the issues of the Depression. And that didn't always match the mood of the country at the time. Of course, people loved to see movies like that because, you know, everybody wanted to be entertained at a dark time. But it's also worth considering that one of the most successful movies of the day was Grapes of Wrath, which was itself based on a hugely popular novel by John Steinbeck, and it was pretty unrepentantly not really socialist in tone, but, you know, very pro-union and very critical of capitalism and very, you know, very much dealing with the poorest of the poor, you know, the Okie immigrants who were coming out to California, and it showed them as being exploited and taken advantage of. So there were a few filmmakers who were sort of making that level of realistic film about the Depression, but for the most part, what the Depression produced in terms of popular film was light entertainment.
people talk about the golden age of Hollywood. You know, that's typically defined as then the late 20s to the late 40s when you had the introduction of sound in motion pictures. So so the start of this golden age coincided with the Great Depression here in America. So what you're saying is you basically see like this huge disconnect between actual life and what's being shown on screen.
It's odd because we think of a lot of movies of that era, you know, like The Bicycle Thief, which is a very devastating portrait of an impoverished man, and Umberto D, which is another very big Italian neorealist film. You know, we think of them in America as being sort of foreign art films, but they were aimed pretty squarely at a mass audience, and most of them did fairly well at the box office, which is not to say that Italy or France or Germany or any of the, you know, countries that were stricken by the Depression at the time were not making their own light comedies and, you know, mere entertainments. But Europeans have always embraced class critiques and, you know, more sort of realistic portrayals of poverty more than Americans have. Americans tend to not like to be reminded that that sort of thing exists. It runs contrary to the national mythology.
Even in period pieces, you know, films that are done much later or depictions of older America eras, you know, you have films like The Godfather Part II, where you see young Vito Corleone in 1920s New York, or you have Deadwood, or you have There Will Be Blood. Do you see a more realistic depiction in those sorts of films?
You know, it sort of depends on through what lens you're claiming realism. You know, in some senses, they're very realistic, you know, and in others, they're not. You know, it all depends on how wide the filmmaker chooses to cast his lens. There's for everyone in Deadwood who, you know, we focused on sort of striving against the crooks of the government who wanted to take control of their own destiny, you know, and you had portrayals of Swearingen, you know, and the sheriff and people like that. But, you know, you didn't focus very much on the miners or on the, you know, the Chinese who were in unbelievably desperate situations compared to the white people who lived in the town. It all depends on the dramatic intention of the filmmaker. Sometimes you're going to see, you know, in There Will Be Blood, obviously you focused on the really wealthy guy who was running the oil rigs and not on the guys who were working on it. It just depends on what kind of story the filmmaker is trying to tell. You know, I think that the sort of an essential difference between American entertainment and European entertainment is that in a show like Deadwood, if it's made in America, it's almost, you know, or I mean, obviously no one's going to make a show like Deadwood in Europe, but, you know, in a setting like that, we're almost certain to focus on a character like Al Swearingen, whereas in Europe, they're much more likely to focus on one of the, you know, say one of the Cornish miners or one of the Chinese workers. You know, they're more likely to tell that guy's story than we are.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, and my name is Kevin Fulham. And today on the show, we're talking about the role of money and wealth in film and television throughout the years. And my guest is Leonard Pierce, who is a pop culture critic and also a film blogger for Nerve.com. Leonard, has television typically been a reliable snapshot of American prosperity in each particular era?
Yeah, television has probably been one of the closest bellwethers to how the American economy is doing. You know, you had when television started out in the 50s, we were undergoing a big economic boom, and that was the era of Ozzie and Harriet and of the Leave It to Beaver family and all these sort of, not rich, but well-off middle-class families with a house out in the suburbs, a nuclear family, and a new car, and a TV set and everything. And there was almost no presence of the underclass whatsoever on television at that era, you know, except towards the late 50s when you started seeing a lot of crime shows. And that kept on through most of the 60s, and then in the late 60s, you know, when you first started to see some letdown in the economy and, you know, on into the 70s when we were facing a serious recession, that's when you first started to see the rise of people like Norman Lear. You started to see television shows like Good Times, and the main characters were not always well-off professionals, you know, or even if they were working class people, they were shown as being pretty happy. You know, that's when you started to see people who actually talked about the economy, that incorporated into their humor or their drama, that you saw people who talked about not being able to make ends meet. And of course, some of that came out of the civil rights era as well, because that was when you started seeing black faces on TV. And naturally, along with that came the depiction of black characters who were obviously, for the most part, in the underclass. And then when the economy started to boom again under Reagan, things changed again. You started to see a lot of shows about really rich people. You started to see shows like Dallas and Dynasty and, you know, even comedies like, instead of seeing stuff like Good Times or All in the Family, you would see stuff like The Cosby Show or The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, where even the black characters were extremely rich. You know, you'd see an occasional show like Family Ties, where there was a generational conflict between the hippie parents who were very idealistic and sort of liberal, and their son, Alex P. Keaton, who was very conservative, you know, is sort of a young Republican character and was all about capitalism and free markets. And then, you know, once again, in recent years, you have a lot of shows like The Hills and, you know, these sort of young, fabulous people shows. And, you know, in the 90s, when there was a boom economy, you had Friends, which I always found to be a really hilarious example of that, because you had a struggling actor in New York City who lived in a gigantic apartment, you know, and so it was so unrealistic, you know, but nobody was really interested in talking about class issues at that time. And then, you know, towards the end of the decade, you started, you know, things started to slump again, and you started to see shows like Roseanne, where people were sort of explicitly talking about class issues. And, you know, you had a family that was depicted as very solidly working class. And, you know, that was not only a fact of their life, but it was a fact of the comedy as well. It was part of the writing of the show was meant to emphasize that. So class has always been a major factor in progressing the picture shown to us on television, and television has always been definitely a big indicator of the economic state of the country.
Going back to the 70s and the 80s, perhaps it's also tougher to do sitcoms about rich characters. You know, you did have the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but that was also kind of played for a contrast because, you know, Will Smith is this character, you know, from the streets in Philadelphia. And The Cosby Show, Dr. Huxtable and his wife both did very well. But for the most part, it just seems if you look at popular shows, you don't really have the rich characters the way you have The Dynasty, the Dallas, Falcon Crest. You have all, even the recent shows, you know, shows like, I guess, The O.C., you mentioned The Hills, you know, very well-off people. It doesn't fall into the category of the American sitcom.
You know, that's the sort of thing that's really going to play into how the show is constructed, you know, and that's when you have to ask yourself, you know, not only what are the rules of depicting class in a particular country, you know, for instance, Britain has always been much more open about depicting class struggles and class differences, both in their dramas and their comedies, whereas in America it's always been a much more taboo subject, even when people are being depicted as rich and poor. But also you have to ask, what are the rules of comedy and what are the rules of drama? And one of the rules of comedy is that comedy rarely stems from an authoritarian position. It's very difficult to make a sympathetic lead out of a guy who's very rich and powerful, because comedy tends to be about mocking the powerful and about showing people in authority out to be fools. So it's difficult to make a comedy that's about really rich people, because they're not all that relatable. They're the ones who you're supposed to be making fun of. But on the other hand, it's also a rule of comedy that you want to be able to let your character do anything. You want to be able to put him in any position or any situation. And if you've written characters who are desperately poor, it's hard to put them in any situation because they can't go anywhere or do anything. And, you know, I think that's why you see a lot of characters who are sort of comfortably upper middle or middle class, because they're obviously not the creme de la creme of society. They're not the super rich or the super powerful, but they're well off enough that they, you know, you can take them on a trip somewhere, you can show them doing something that poor people would not be able to do. So, you know, I think a lot of it just sort of falls into not only what's the conventions for displaying wealth and class, but also what do you need to do with your story. So it's not often as clear-cut as, do I want my character to be rich or not? It's what do I want to be able to do with him?
You mentioned The Cosby Show being a landmark show of the mid-80s. Following shows like Good Times and also Sanford and Son, Red Fox and Sanford and Son in the late 70s, depicting working-class black households.
In The Jeffersons, it was about a wealthy black family, but the comedy came from their conflicts with other wealthy people. You know, that so in that way, it was really more about race and class than it was about wealth, because, you know, a lot of the laughs on the show came from the fact that George Jefferson was as wealthy as any of the people that he hung around with, but he didn't have the same background or the same class experience as they did. So, you know, he was still sort of treated like they would treat a poor black character. And that's so I always sort of think of it in that category, even though he's portrayed as being a wealthy guy, you know, he's still a sort of Fred Sanford sort of character.
Cosby Show is very interesting because, you know, you have black academics and sociology very split on the impact of the Cosby Show with regards to America's views on race relations. You know, and you have the side says, hey, you know, it's great that we finally have, you know, a very well-to-do black family in America, just like all the other shows depicting white families. And then you have the other side that says, well, wait a minute, a show like The Cosby Show has actually desensitized people to the issues of racism. And like, well, you know, look at The Cosbys, they're doing fine, so we don't have to worry about that as an issue anymore.
And I mean, it's sort of no coincidence that Bill Cosby himself, the person rather than the sitcom character, has become a very similar polarizing figure. Today, there are people in the black community who say, well, he's a great guy. He's made this big success of himself. He's always taken responsibility for his actions. He's a role model for the black community. But there are others in the black community who say, well, you know, he's been so rich for so long. He's very conservative. He doesn't understand contemporary black culture. And he makes these statements about the way that black people should behave that, you know, if we heard them from a white man, we would consider them racist. So, you know, even at many years after the show has gone off the air, he's still a very polarizing figure along those same lines. Was Cliff Huxtable a role model for the black community, or was he this sort of whitewashed character that helped white people alleviate their guilt over, you know, the way that most black people were still being treated? So you can ask those same questions about Bill Cosby today.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined by Leonard Pierce, who is a film blogger for Nerve.com, and we're talking about the role of money in film and television throughout the years, the depiction of wealth in sitcoms, films of each era, and how they depict the desire for wealth. You also mentioned briefly Family Ties and the Alex P. Keaton character, who is a character that basically served to, or one of the forces, I guess, in pop culture serving to make the desire for wealth a good thing, a popular thing. You know, he's one of the icons, I guess, of the mid-80s. And here's a guy whose life revolved around money. He dreamed of acquiring riches. And then also later that decade, you have a film like Wall Street, Oliver Stone film, with Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko, and you have the famous Greed is Good speech.
You know, Wall Street's a really interesting movie in that regard because Oliver Stone based the character on his own father, who was a very wealthy stock trader and businessman with whom he had a very contentious relationship. And Stone, for all of his reputation as sort of a liberal troublemaker, is there have been people who have called him the world's most conservative liberal because he certainly doesn't toe the line of the traditional liberal. And one of the interesting things about not only Gordon Gekko in Wall Street, but Alex P. Keaton in Family Ties, and, you know, a lot of these characters, is that people see in those characters their own positions reflected. And so at the very same time, liberals were laughing at Alex P. Keaton and saying, what a joke this kid is. You know, he's so square and, you know, he's such a greedy little jerk. Conservatives were praising him and saying, oh, it's about time we saw a character like this on TV who is, you know, sort of a good Reaganite and isn't some hippy-dippy, you know, loves everybody kid. And, you know, at the same time that a lot of liberal filmgoers were looking at Gordon Gekko and saying, you know, what a cretinous, greedy jerk, you know, how can anybody watch this movie and think that he's somebody to look up to? You had a number of the big stock traders in the 80s, you know, Michael Milken gave a speech in which he sort of echoed that greed is good thing. You know, he put forth Gordon Gekko as someone to be emulated and, you know, I mean, even right down to the clothes that he was wearing, you know, the whole suspender thing became a little trend on Wall Street when the movie came out. So conservatives were looking at that very same character and saying, you know, oh, that's a good character to emulate. You know, we don't see characters like that enough. He's right. Greed is good. So it's very interesting that you had these characters who both sides of the political equation were claiming as a symbol for something, you know. For the conservatives, they were somebody to be looked up to, and for liberals, they were somebody to be condemned. And yet they were both watching the same characters, you know, written by the same people.
If you take a snapshot of the films of the 80s, you have the John Hughes comedy films. They're all basically, you know, set in places like Winnetka here, you know, the North Shore of the Chicago area, where, you know, no one has to worry about money. And these are all wealthy white kids for the most part. Cinema takes a sharp turn in the early 90s with the depiction of inner city life with regards to, you have Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing that came out, I believe, right around 1990 or so. You also have a John Singleton film, Boys in the Hood, where there's this famous speech where Lawrence Fishburne's character educates his son on gentrification, you know, with the Asian community moving into the neighborhood and kicking the African-Americans out.
I used to have a friend before I moved to Chicago who told me that if you wanted to get a sense of what Chicago was like if you were wealthy, you should watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And if you wanted to get a depiction of what Chicago was like if you were poor, you should watch the Blues Brothers. And, you know, I always thought that was kind of a funny thing to say, but the one common denominator between those two shows, and of course the common denominator between the shows you talked about and the movies that you talked about in the 80s when the economy was booming and the 90s when it was slumping, is black people. You know, you could watch a dozen John Hughes movies all set in Chicago and never see any black people. And you could watch a dozen Spike Lee and John Singleton movies all set in L.A. in the early 90s and never see any white people, you know, except portrayed, you know, as villains or, you know, sources of angst. And so there's obviously two hugely different experiences coming out of those filmmakers. You know, obviously Spike Lee grew up in New York, you know, in a generally impoverished area, you know, and John Hughes grew up in a very lily-white suburb of Chicago. And, you know, they both brought their particular sensibilities to their films, but it also had to do with the time those films got made. I think it's no coincidence that Spike Lee's career began booming at the same time that John Hughes' career began slumping. You know, the national mood had turned against his sort of lily white, you know, everything's okay depiction of the suburbs, and it had turned more towards the sort of urban decay vibe of the early 90s and late 80s. You know, it's not only their racial background, but also the time at which their movies were made. I don't think Spike Lee would have been as successful if he had started out in the early 80s. And, I mean, obviously, John Hughes' career really slumped in the 90s. So I always remember, and this was something that I mentioned in one of the AV Club articles I wrote a while back, is that there's that famous scene in The Breakfast Club where the character Bender is complaining about Claire's new earrings that her daddy bought her. And it's meant to be this sort of, you know, really heavy class confrontation. And he talks about how his dad just got him a carton of cigarettes. And it was meant to be this sort of really devastating, oh, my family's super poor and your family's super rich, and how can you understand my lifestyle? I remember when I watched it at the time that, you know, I thought, well, gee, a lot of kids would be happy to get a carton of Christmas, you know. At least you didn't just get them a pack of cigarettes, you know.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, we're talking about the role of money in film and television throughout the years. And because we're talking briefly about films like Boys in the Hood and Do the Right Thing that came out in the early 90s, I want to segue and talk a little bit about the depiction of wealth in hip-hop, because that's always struck me as very fascinating, because you have this huge clash between, say, the depiction of wealth in hip-hop versus rock music, you know, where you have slews of videos, especially in the 90s, we have rappers flaunting luxury cars and jewelry and what have you. Meanwhile, on the flip side, you don't see any sort of flaunting of wealth in the rock community, you know, and guys like Springsteen and Bono, they wouldn't want you at all to think that they're insanely rich, which of course they are. And
yeah, well, I mean, there was a brief sort of flaring in the 70s with glam rock and that sort of lifestyle of, you know, if you've got it, flaunt it, and, you know, the beautiful people, Mick Jagger and his wife showing off how wealthy they were. But as a rule, yeah, nowadays, guys like Bruce Springsteen and Bono go out of their way to sort of present themselves as friends of the working class. That was Springsteen's whole shtick for quite a long time, is that he was the millionaire rock star who was really a working class guy from New Jersey, you know?
You had all those guys, John Mellencamp with Farm Aid, for instance, you know,
yeah,
with...
Sure. And, you know, I think that that sort of dualism runs into the backgrounds of both of those groups. You know, when you have white guys who come from a relatively privileged background, if they get really wealthy, they're going to pursue this sort of quest for authenticity. You know, they don't want anybody to think that they're just these sort of dilettantes who are co-opting working class culture. And so they go out of their way to sort of establish these sort of shows of solidarity with the working class and, you know, with the working man, and, you know, say that their stuff is really authentic and real, and it comes from the true source. You know, they're very much about authenticity and about, you know, saying, well, it's not about the money, it's not about that for me. Whereas, you know, in hip-hop, where you have people, you know, a ton of people who genuinely come from terrible poverty, you know, a lot of these guys come from the slums and from, you know, public housing projects, they're nakedly greedy. You know, they're like, as soon as they get money, you know, of course, that's actually become a subject of contention in the rap community with a lot of the more conscious rappers saying, you know, well, you guys are setting a bad example. You know, the minute you get money, you don't have enough money to buy a house yet, but you buy these $20,000 gold necklaces and, you know, these big old cars that you can't afford. And if your record doesn't sell, they're going to get repossessed. And you're just, you're still playing into white people's hands. That's sort of the situation with a lot of impoverished subcultures going all the way back to, you know, I mean, when you had the mafia, it was very big. A lot of mafiosi were sort of famous for putting on these vulgar displays of power. They would buy these huge Cadillac cars and really fancy suits and big gold chains. And, you know, they would just spend their wealth very ostentatiously because they had been raised so poor and they didn't care about authenticity or playing down their wealth. They wanted to show it up because they didn't, you know, they were not used to having it. And so the minute they got it, they were all about, you know, showing it off and flaunting it. And hip-hop guys sort of buy the big chains and flaunt it, make the videos with the hoochie mamas and, you know, show themselves parading around some giant mansion, you know. I mean, even like Jay-Z in one of his biggest hits talks about, you know, hey, he rejects the criticism that he shouldn't be rapping about his wealth. In 99 Problems, he says critics attack him for singing about how rich he is and how much stuff he has. And he says, you know, well, I'm from the hood. You know, what kind of facts are those? What kind of rules are those? When you grew up like me, you celebrate the minute you have money. It's become a sort of cultural expectation that once you reach that level of success in the hip-hop world, you're supposed to flaunt it. And, you know, as I said, there's sort of a minor criticism coming to that from sort of some of the more conscious rappers and, of course, from the American mainstream, too, you know, that it's just considered a vulgar sort of thing to do. But within the community itself, it's considered almost de rigueur, you know, to once you've got the money to show it off. And nobody expects that from rock stars. You know, as you say, people would be appalled if Bono started writing a song about how great it was to be so rich and all the things that he bought. You know, people would just hate him if he did that. But the expectations are very different from people who are perceived as having grown up in deprivation. It's considered forgivable or even expected to do that.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who is a film blogger for Nerve.com, amongst his many other writing assignments. And we're talking about the depiction of wealth in popular culture, mostly with film and television, but talking a little bit about the depiction of the desire for wealth and money in the music industry as well, too, in the music world. So the depiction of economic issues, the role of money in our views of the future, whether you're talking about the Star Trek universe or Star Wars universe, we talked a little bit on the phone last week in preparation for the show about the unique role of money in a show like Star Trek.
The absent role of money.
The absent role of money, yeah. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
You know, science fiction has traditionally been a sort of, at least in its most popular manifestations, it's a sort of escapist, you know, genre. And I think that a lot of people who create science fiction, they're obviously people of ideas, you know, they come up with all kinds of wild ideas, but they don't always think them through, you know, they don't always create a sort of, and, you know, while this is very appealing to science fiction fans to create a very elaborate world-building scenario where you sort of gradually reveal the depth and breadth of this fictional universe you've created, I've always been kind of stricken that a lot of popular science fiction franchises like Star Wars and Star Trek are very almost deliberately vague about how the economy works, you know. And so like in Star Trek, which I'm not the world's biggest Star Trek fan, but in the shows that I have seen there, in the original series, they were very vague about exactly how the economy worked. And, you know, there were references to people having credits and sort of spending them as if they were currency. But you also have this implication that the United Federation of Planets was a unified thing and that there was really no deprivation. And when there were political conflicts, you know, or military conflicts with like the Klingons or the Romulans, it was more because they were sort of evil and imperialist rather than that they were fighting over resources. And, you know, you had these devices on every ship that could synthesize food and drink and synthesize clothes and sort of make things out of nothing, which would solve pretty much any economic problem that you would have, you know. I mean, it would maybe create a whole different set of economic problems, but, you know, it would certainly solve the problem of deprivation and poverty. And in Star Wars as well, you know, again, you have these vague references to credits and people spent money places, but money didn't seem to be a big deal. You know, it was more like you had this conflict between the Imperial government and the Rebel Alliance, and they got into some, you know, in the sequels, they got into some really kind of impenetrable stuff about trading and everything, but it was still sort of left vague exactly how the economy worked and why the Imperial government was set up a particular way versus the way the Alliance was set up another particular way. And I always found that very frustrating because I thought there was a lot of potential for that if you were going to create this whole fictional universe to sort of establish what the rules of the economy were. And yet you almost never saw that. You saw these very nebulous references to how the economy worked, and you never really knew much about it at all.
In the Star Wars movies, the only time you saw the real money at all is the initial haggling over the fare to Alderaan, right, between Han Solo and Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, and it wasn't really clear, like, what the economy was backed by, or if you were a member of the Rebel Alliance, why you would be dealing with currency issued by the Imperial government or anything like that. And, you know, of course, that brings us to the contemporary version of Battlestar Galactica, which I think is a tremendous show, but one of the most hated of all episodes was the Black Market episode. And one reason that people frequently cite that they didn't like the episode is because it was predicated on the existence of a sort of, you know, of a black market, buying and selling of illicit goods for currency run by a criminal syndicate. And that premise doesn't make any sense in a situation like Battlestar Galactica, where you have a tiny population with an extremely limited number of natural resources where nobody really produces anything. You know, how could you possibly have a black market, you know, when resources are so completely shared amongst such a tiny amount of people, you know? And so it wasn't so much that the episode didn't work dramatically, although it didn't, but it was because the whole premise didn't make much sense. You know, it was obvious they hadn't really thought about the economics of the way that their show was set up. And I always found that very curious, you know, and I know there are plenty of science fiction shows and books and things like that that do give that sort of thing a great deal more thought. But it's interesting how the bigger ones, you know, the more popular ones, just sort of elide that topic altogether and seem to not want to get into it.
Is this something that you see fleshed out very much in depictions of America in the near future?
You know, in fact, it's when you have sort of near future dystopias, economics is actually often a very big factor in them. I mean, one of the movies that instantly comes to mind is Mad Max and the Road Warrior, where it's made very clear that, you know, what's happened is that the economy has collapsed because of a, you know, an oil shortage of a, you know, what they call the peak oil syndrome. You know, eventually the oil's going to run out. When the oil runs out, the energy runs out. When the energy runs out, the economy collapses. And so that was made very explicit in Mad Max and in The Road Warrior. And also you see in a lot of 70s dystopia films, you know, like Soylent Green is one of the ones that economics is a huge factor in it.
You have a rampant overpopulation. You have a jar of strawberry preserves now goes for $150 because it's so rare now to have fresh fruit, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and Rollerball, at least in the original version and to some extent in the remake, economics is a big deal. It's portrayed as a period of deprivation where they have these Britain circuses, entertainments for the people, and big corporations arrange them all. Similarly, you have Blade Runner, where in the movie, certainly, and in the book to a great degree, you have a lot of class issues which are driven by deprivation. You know, in the movie, it's implied that all the people who are well-off enough have left the planet completely. You know, the people who remain are sort of the underclass, and they tend to be more ethnic minorities than anything else. And Deckard feels a lot of class shame because he can't afford a mechanical animal, which is this sort of very ostentatious display of wealth. And we're shown the Tyrell Corporation and these other big mega corporations are the ones that are running the world. So you definitely have a flavor of especially 70s dystopias, which make very explicit the economic conditions. But those tend to almost all be based on Earth, and their science fictional elements are very immediate. It seems like that stuff gets more distant as you set the stuff in an alien habitat and sort of remove it from contemporary issues.
Would you expect to see a return in terms of those kinds of films, the near future economic collapse in America based on the current situation?
Yeah, I think so. I think not only in a dystopian sense, in a science fictional sense, but I think we're also going to be seeing a lot more films set in the contemporary era that are about poverty and about deprivation. I think you're already seeing that in documentaries. You're seeing way more documentaries about poverty and about poor working conditions and about environmental degradation. You're just generally seeing a lot more movies about the effects of the economy on people than you used to. And even in drama, you know, that's starting to come up. I think one of the best films of 2008 was an independent movie, Wendy and Lucy. And it was, you know, it's about this young woman who decides she's going to go to Alaska in search of a better job because she's really impoverished and she doesn't really have a support network. So she and her dog, they decide they're going to drive to Alaska, and the car breaks down in Oregon. Basically, she doesn't have any money to fix the car, and she can't get a job in Oregon. It's just really heartbreaking, you know. It's very realistic in the way that people with no money make these very basic financial decisions about, you know, going without one meal in order to be able to buy gas or something like that. And tonally, it's very much in the tradition of Italian neorealism. You know, there's a very kind of unsentimental, realistic depiction of the lives of the poor. The movie Wendy and Lucy was very highly acclaimed when it came out, and I think certainly if current predictions about how the economy is going are proved to be true, then we're going to see more movies like that than less.
Well, the movie that just came to mind was Midnight Cowboy. It came out, I think, right around 69 with John Voight's character moving from small town America to the big city, to New York, and trying to make a living as a male prostitute, male gigolo, and runs out of money, and you see him, his life just deteriorating. He becomes homeless and gets ill. And
there was actually a film, it just occurred to me, you know, Japan underwent a major financial crisis in the 1990s, and in the mid-2000s, I think 2003 or 2004, there was a really amazing movie from Japan by Hirozaku Kurita called Nobody Knows. It was about these kids whose parents abandoned them. They just didn't have any money to raise the kids anymore, and so the parents abandoned them in this ratty little apartment, and it starts out that they're just having a lot of fun, you know, they're kids, and so they just end up spending whatever money they have on junk food and playing video games, and eventually the money starts running out and there's no way to get any more. So the kids just start becoming more and more desperate. At one point there's just this heartbreaking scene where one of the brothers tries to call the mother on the payphone, and he keeps feeding coins into the payphone to try and keep the line open while he's trying to reach her, and he eventually can't reach her, and he realizes at the end that all that money is gone now. You know, he can never get that money back that he spent trying to get hold of his mom, and it's just this really heartbreaking scene, and it's a movie that's very much informed by the economic crisis that Japan underwent in the 90s, so, you know, it's hardly a unique phenomenon to the United States.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and we've been talking about the role of money in film and television throughout the years, the depiction of wealth and also the desire for wealth, whether that's American sitcoms, whether it's various films of each era. And my guest is Leonard Pierce, who is a pop culture critic and also a film blogger for Nerve.com. I want to talk a few moments about the film Fight Club. The David Fincher film that came out right around 1999, I believe, with Brad Pitt and Edward Norton, based off the Chuck Palahniuk book, where you have a definite attack on the materialism of America in the mid-90s, in the late 90s. And what were your thoughts on the film Fight Club?
Well, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a very well-made film. I thought it was well-acted. It was very funny. And, you know, of course, being a Fincher film, it's very stylish, you know, enjoyable to watch. But I think there's something kind of interesting about its economic critique, because it's the product of a society in a wealthy phase. It's got this extremely deep and sort of hateful, not really hateful, I suppose, but very radical critique of consumer capitalism. And yet it was, you know, written and made in the Clinton 90s when everything was booming. It sort of reminded me of some of the more violent revolutionary movements and rhetoric that were happening in Europe, with the Red Brigades in Italy and the Bader-Meinhofs in Germany in the 70s, and some of the similar movements in Europe and Asia that happened during boom times, you know, that they had these really savage critiques of consumer capitalism at a time when pretty much everyone was, you know, not everyone was well off, but, you know, as a rule, the country was doing quite well. And there are certain types of this sort of radical critique that can only emerge in a society that's doing well, because when everybody's struggling during the Depression, you know, you don't have time to entertain these sort of thoughts of radical violence because you're too busy just trying to feed yourself. You know, I think like during the Depression in the United States, you had situations where you'd have a movie like The Grapes of Wrath, which was advocating these very practical, you know, albeit to a, you know, an extremely capitalist perspective, very socialist solutions, you know, these ideas about unemployment insurance and Social Security and welfare to work programs and, you know, just all the sort of New Deal programs that were anathema to the traditional conservative point of view. But, you know, it's not like, you know, everybody was out there advocating the total overthrow of the system. You know, they were like, well, what can the government do to fix things right now, you know, and help get people who are in terrible poverty into a decent situation? The really radical rhetoric sort of tuned down at that time. Whereas, you know, in the more prosperous period of the, you know, the 50s and early 60s, you had, you know, the beatniks who were delivering a pretty radical critique of capitalism, you know, more systemic, let's overthrow the whole dirty, rotten system, you know. And that's the sort of feel that you get from Fight Club, too, you know, which, again, those were both movements that came about in very successful periods of American capitalism. So, you know, I think when things are really bad, people tend to think of more practical solutions. And then when things are really good, they allow their imagination to run a bit riot and allow themselves to think of more, I shouldn't say utopian, but more, you know, sort of radical, world-changing.
Also, I think it was very interesting about Fight Club is that they want to tear down corporate America but replace it with this kind of fascist army. You know, they have
right.
Project Mayhem where they all wear the same black shirts and no one has any names.
And, you know, interestingly enough, I have not read the book, but I do know from the film that most of the people who are involved in Project Mayhem, they're not shown as being poor people. They tend to be people like the main character, like the narrator, you know, they're from fairly comfortable corporate jobs, you know, they're making a decent living, they're just unsatisfied. And so it's not like this is some kind of communist movement or, you know, revolutionary union movement or something with actual working people who are fed up with their bad conditions. You know, it's more like these, you know, somewhat privileged people who are drifting towards fascism more or less out of a sense of dissatisfaction with a society that's actually made them very comfortable.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and my guest has been Leonard Pierce, who's a pop culture critic. He's also a film blogger for Nerve.com. His website can be found at ludikid.com. It's ludickid.com. And anything in particular that you're working on right now, Leonard?
I'm working on a number of projects right now, but my work can always be found at the Screen Grab, the Nerve.com film blog, or at the Onion AV Club every week.
Leonard, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
I'm always happy to be on, Kevin. Thanks.